Okay, so I want to welcome you all here today, and in the past I've had some great response on my weekly emails and my monthly teleconference calls. I'd like to actually start calling it a teleseminar. I think that that's a pretty effective way of putting this information together for you guys. And most recently I've had a large amount of requests on my marketing action worksheet. This worksheet is just a simple little sheet that basically gets us to focus our ideas and our goals on marketing. And it stemmed from a weekly email that I sent down. It really created quite a flurry of emails to me and requests, so I was really excited about that. And there are many people now that are utilizing this marketing action worksheet, and they're getting great results for their organization, so I'm proud of that. Just this morning, just before Joanne and I were talking about how busy schedules are, but just this morning I had the privilege of attending a seminar with the world-renowned J. Conrad Levinson. Mr. Levinson is the author of almost 40 books and is most famous for all of his guerrilla marketing programs and books. This seminar was amazing this morning, and I'll share some of the concepts in the future via email or another conference call. But today's topic is a hot one. In fact, I've gotten emails already on people's expectations of what I'm about to say. Interestingly enough, some people believe that I'm going to speak about actual physical movements or what I call techniques, and they've made it clear to me that they're going to be listening and ready to defend their arts to the hilt. So I want to be clear that I will not be talking about what you should do physically, but more so on how to develop your own curriculum and make it more effective for you as a school owner. So starting our conference call, Developing the Ultimate Curriculum. Just to give you an idea, 15 years ago I opened my first school, and I'm not exactly sure at the time what motivated me to do it. And sometimes I think back, like probably most of you, and I want to kick myself for actually opening up a school. But, you know, lo and behold, it's a really rewarding program. It's a rewarding, you know, field of business to be in. And, you know, when the smoke clears from all the tension and so on, I'm usually very, very happy that my life is what I love. You know, I do what I want to do for a living, and I make a good living at it, and I'm able to help people. So initially when I opened my first location, I was the spitting image of my American ninjutsu instructor. I taught like him, taught what he taught, and I even spoke with a Spanish accent. If you could believe this, this is the oddest thing, because as you can tell by my my voice that I don't speak with a Spanish accent. But the way I was brought up, I actually learned classes listening to my teacher, and when I ended up teaching, I actually spoke just like him as well. So it's interesting, because when we all look back, we're creatures of our own upbringing to some extent. Somewhere logged in our inner thoughts is an imprint of how we're programmed and how we react. So my first teacher, he was a great martial artist in a physical sense, but he really didn't have a clue on how to teach and run a professional school. In my opinion, it was kind of a dysfunctional nightmare. Normally a class consisted of an assortment of whatever he wanted to teach, and mostly it was a spur of the moment. Even though this type of curriculum was exciting for me, it was no real way to monitor my success or the other student's success, ability, and progress. So each student was at a different level depending on their understanding, but not depending on their ability. For example, two students training for the same duration of time with a similar physical ability could be at an entirely different level. The movements, the kata, which are our forms, and even the self-defense moves were not required to gain ranking. So it really all depended on how much you showed up to class, how hard you worked, and whether the teacher really recognized you and liked you. There was no rhyme or reason to the methods he used, so some people got promoted and others didn't. So when my first school opened up, I started to grow, and I had about 30 to 40 students, and then I grew to 50 to 75, and then possibly before I moved into my new location, I was at about 150. And I realized that in order for me to grow anymore, things had to change. And other than knowing business and running my business and having all these systems that we talk about all the time, I knew that there were other things that had to be different. And at the time, I met my teacher from Japan, and I was so excited about following him and his teachings. And he had a curriculum that was written in stone. To me, It was like being in college. We kept notebooks and studied many different family lines, which we call in Japanese the Ruha. And as we progressed through the ranks, we started to become experts at this knowledge. Even though I was really happy, I still saw flaws as I grew within the ranking. The difference that I saw with my Japanese teacher versus my American teacher was the overload of material as well as the monotony of the material. So even though my Japanese master didn't look, I looked at it differently than my American teacher, there were still similar character traits and problems that had gone on. The curriculum with my Japanese teacher, as interesting and detailed as it may have been, was so overwhelming to many students, so they became frustrated in their quest and their development. Some would learn moves and they would cram the moves before the test, sort of like we crammed for tests in public school, and they would pass their tests but never really mastered the movements or the techniques. They would forget them shortly after they learned. And on another note, too much curriculum is not a good thing either. So we have to ask ourselves, what's the happy medium? And, you know, what's the happy medium in what we do? You know, so before I move forward in developing the perfect curriculum, I have a few points that I'd like to make. And even though that you may, as a martial arts school owner, be set in your ways and what you currently are doing, you must constantly be evolving. No matter how great you think your stuff is, you have to look at it and take a look, a strong look, and regularly improve it and compare it to what's going on. So here are a few things. When I developed my curriculum, I started with the end in mind, and these are the things I highly recommend. Number one, I started from second degree black belt. Actually, I started from fourth degree black belt in my system, fourth degree, which we call fourth dan, and I worked my way backwards. I recommend if you do not have a curriculum set in stone right now, and even if you do, look up to at least your first or second degree black belt and work backwards. Remember that what you see is not always what others see. So think through the eyes of your students. Number two, break your curriculum up and make it age-specific. Now, age-specific is a buzzword that goes on within our industry now. You know, everybody is teaching an age-specific curriculum, but I wonder, is it really age-specific? So my curriculum starts at an adult level, fourth degree black belt, and it works back to beginner level. Then I break the style down in three categories: the teen group, the mighty warrior group, as I call it, and the little warrior group, as I call it, which is my 5 to 8 year olds and then my 3 to 5 year olds. Now, when I broke my curriculum out, I basically took the adult curriculum and I thinned it down for the teenagers, then thinned it down a little bit more for what we call our mighty warrior 5 to 8, and then a little bit more for our little warriors. So this is important, and we'll go over this a little bit more. Number three, you know, we, like I said before, we've heard the buzzword about everything being age-specific, and although I agree with it 100%, the fact of the matter is that many of the age-specific curriculums for children are nothing more than glorified daycare centers. So I suggest that you give the martial art curriculum some substance. Remember why you started and why you got involved in the martial arts, and be true to who you are, because in the end result, the result is benefits, and if they join your school to learn martial arts, that's what they have to be doing at the end of the day. So just make sure that you have some substance in your age-specific training. Number four, also think with the end in mind and don't look at your curriculum through what we call black belt eyes. When I promoted my first black belt, the test was difficult, somewhat out of the 1970s karate movies that I watched, you know, Kung Fu Theater on Channel 5 on Saturday afternoons. But by the time I did my next group of black belts, the people that I had testing were, you know, extremely nervous because the test that I had presented to them that I was going to do the next time around was even more difficult than the first time. And I continued doing this for quite some time until I realized later that I was discouraging all my new candidates due to their expectations, knowing that they knew what one test was from before and they knew that it was continually getting more and more difficult. So what I did was set up standardized testing for my students to follow, and I even at black belt level, I began a 10-week black belt success cycle, and I have a set test letting the students know what's expected of them and what they need to perfect so that there are really no questions asked. This leads to my next topic. When developing your curriculum, think about the capabilities of the student and the boundaries in which you can push them without breaking them. Now, remember, when I first opened my school, it was about a 600-square-foot facility. My first intro class was a full-contact kickboxing class. you know, we would pound our new recruits into the ground, or may I be more accurate by saying we would pound them into the walls. In fact, this is not a metaphor. It's a reality. Every single night we would end up each class by all the senior ranks getting together and spackling the walls to prepare them for the next class for the next day. I wondered why my students stick around. I would justify their quitting by saying that they just couldn't handle it anyway and they'd never make it in the martial arts. But this was not totally true. And for the most of it, I was making sure, you know, I was basically ensuring that these people would not prosper and continue. And after all, ask yourself the question, how could they? You know, the ones that did were really the toughest of the tough. And, you know, we all could agree, the people who just made it through the craziest training in our early days that are still around, they're not the normal individuals. Not saying that they're odd, but they're just not normal. Not every single person will stick around through that. So anyway, I continued on with that until one day one of my dear friends came and watched my classes, and he told me that he was really impressed with the level of efficiency that my 30 students had. But he then asked me a question that had changed my entire paradigm. The goal of his question was to get me to think. And he asked me, are you helping people or are you hurting people by teaching the way you do? And I have to say that when I went home that night, I wasn't happy about his question. As a matter of fact, I was quite offended. But after thinking about it, I realized that I was doing more harm to people than I was helping them. So I urge you to ask yourself the same question. Is your curriculum good enough to sustain long-term student growth? And is it designed to benefit the student, or is it an extension of your ego or your teacher's ego even? So here are a few items that I want you to think about. Number one, is your curriculum set up for rank advancement above black belt? Because obviously if we continue saying that our school is a black belt school, we teach black belt excellence, we are a black belt society, whatever the black belt metaphor may be, and you only have a few black belts in your school, somehow your curriculum is short-sighted. Somehow that curriculum is falling short of achieving the goal and continuing with what you say you do. So you have to ask yourself, is your curriculum set up for rank advancement above black belt? You know, number two, are you setting your students up for failure? Simply by not being clear on what's expected of them. I see that in my business with my employees. If I'm not clear on my description and the vision that I believe people should have, the people, they easily lose sight of what's expected of them and what they're about to do, sometimes creating them to be so demotivated that I call it the analysis paralysis, where they just sit and do nothing. So we want to make sure that we're not setting our students up for failure. Three, we need to build a clear vision for them. When I was a little kid, I used to love the TV show I Dream of Jeannie. For those people around my age, know that I Dream of Jeannie was starred in the show by Barbara Eden. She was amazingly beautiful. In one episode, I remember that as a genie, she manifested a machine that appeared to be like one of those old-time movie cameras where they have the handle crank on the right side of the camera. And in her show, you would put in coins, and depending on whether you spun the handle forward or backwards, you would either go forward or backward in time. Wouldn't it be nice if we could give our students a glimpse where they would be if they took a specific route in their training? Just like the movie The Butterfly Effect with Ashton Kutcher, each move we do or each thing that we do or each second in time shapes our future. So what we need to do with our students is paint a great and clear picture for them so that we know and they know where they will be as if they continue on a specific pathway. And of course, we're going to veer off direction, but it's our goal as martial art teachers to kind of drag them back in. But it's also our goal to monitor their progress and help them move forward and progress forward. The fourth one I have right now is have programs in place that will allow the students to progress towards the role of teaching or assisting in classes. Because you know what? In college, there's one end result. People get out of school, they graduate remedial high school, then they go on to college. If college was an endless training lesson, like our martial arts schools are, we hope that our students will stay with this forever and eternity. We want them to be our students and possibly open up their own school. We want them to grow and stay within our school. We want them to be a part of what we do forever. If that was the same mentality in the colleges, then they would never get out and actually start their lives. So I'm not saying that we want them to graduate from our schools and move on, but we want to paint a picture and have programs in place for them to progress towards the role of teaching or assisting in classes. We want to set out the vision for them and show them clear expectations of what and show them what they can expect and what they'll get out of it and what opportunities lie ahead. Sometimes students just get to a point where they achieve their black belt and they feel like, hey, I've gotten there. And they don't believe that there's anything left for them to learn, to do, and that's where boredom sits in. So we want to make sure that we have different programs in place and we create an incredible vision. So now, going on, as I looked at my curriculum, I looked back at the statistics. Fortunately, I had some very valuable information to look at. I was able to look at the age, the sex of the student, male or female, and the rank of each student when they were quitting my school. Some things were really evident when we looked at them under a microscope. And I realized that even though I was saying that we were a black school, black belt school, we were so far from that because we had many students quitting before achieving their black belts. So also I was able to see clearly by looking at my statistics where the students were getting frustrated and discontinuing. And once I looked at it in that way, under a microscope, as if I were doing an interview, it was easy to see. And then I had to ask all the right questions. For example, when we looked at our curriculum at the time, some 8 or 9 years ago, I had only about 4 black belts, and I had about 10 brown belts in the wings. Unfortunately, half of those brown belts went on to quit, and before I knew it, the ones that did achieve their black belts joined the small rank because other black belts had quit. It was a vicious cycle. So once I looked closely, we were able to identify many of the problems. And through careful experimentation and interviewing existing and old students, we made some real extreme changes. Now, right now, currently in my school, we have about 100 active training black belts. And we have approximately, 40 to 60 brown belts waiting in the wings to be promoted over the next year. We have about 15% of our enrollment is either a black belt or a brown belt. And that's not bad, right? So if you could look at your statistics and say, okay, if you have a school of 100 students, you should have at least 10 to 15 black belts, depending on where you stand. Let me point out to you some of the sticking points that we found when we reviewed our statistics. The first thing we found was the lack of progress for beginners. It was very important, no matter how old the student was, whether they were 3 or 35 or 55, they needed to see progress. So I believe that the first year or so, maybe the first 2 years, to be one of the major sticking points, and probably the most important thing is to see those students progressing on a regular basis. Not saying giving belts out for what they don't deserve, and I'm going to get into this in a little while, but really most importantly, making sure that we know that they're progressing forward. Because if they're not, they're going to quit. If they don't see the progress, they're going to leave. Number two, I want you to monitor the student's success and give them continual feedback and motivation in the early stages. This is clear to see. I'll say it again. Monitor the student's success and give them continual feedback and motivation in the early stages. In fact, today at my seminar with J. Conrad Levinson, he said that when interviewing businesses, the reason why most businesses said that they stayed with a specific dealer or a client stayed with a specific business was not due to price, it was not due to service, it was due to seeing the progress in the relationship. So this is very, very important that we monitor our students to make sure that they could see their progress and we always continually motivate or remotivate and give them continual feedback. Number three, make sure that you establish a good line of communication with your students, the parents, and whoever else you would consider a client, whether it be a grandmother or whatever. You need to immediately explain to them your methods and what you expect from the both of them. You need to establish with the students and the parents whether they're going to be a specific kind of student. You've probably heard some of the other seminar consultants say to categorize your students in an A, B, or C student. Now, continually in my school, we try to, we do it a lot less than we should, but we rate our students in the categories of A, B, and C. We want to establish whether they're motivated And if they are, and they're training every single day, and they're excited, and they're happy, they're an A student. Anything less may get a B or a C rating. The interesting thing is that we never truly find out from our students what kind of treatment that they actually want. And what I mean by this is explaining to the student what an A student is and what an A student acts like and what we expect from them and what a B student and a C student does as well. If they fully understand the concepts of how we're trying to rate them, you may want to ask them at that point, what do they want to be? Some may not have the time to be an A student. For example, if you require them to go to all the special events and teach or help in class in order to be an A student, then they may not have the time or energy. So it may be highly discouraging to them if they're not looked at as an A student. So if they can't do it, then this may slow their motivation, and you may never get them to turn around or change or see the results or jump from A, B, or C. So something that I'm starting to initiate in my school is ask the student what they believe our role is as a teacher in their life. What do they expect from us? Because I don't want a student that I believe that I could push to their limit. I don't want them to quit because they think that I'm too pushy. I don't want a student that doesn't like being pushed to quit because he thinks that I'm going to, you know, be too hard on them. I want to know what they expect to get out of it. You know, there's going to be a fine line where we have to figure that out, but we need to make sure that our curriculum has that set in it. The fourth thing, sometimes what we want for our students is not what they want for themselves. The saying, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. Well, even though this may be true, you have to realize that some students just don't want what we want. They just don't love what we do as much as we love it. So, or there may be a different thing. A parent may have a totally different philosophy. So even though through the years of lessons, the student's mentality may change if we're teaching the child and they grow up in our classroom, but the parent who's not 100% engaged may not ever see the true benefits. After all, how can they? No one knows what it's like to get hit in the face, you know, boxing, if they only watch boxing on TV every night. You have to be involved to experience, to feel, to be able to see what it is to be involved with a synergistic kind of energy. You know, to be in a classroom is much different than to watch a classroom. So I would like to see you guys make sure that you find out, you know, what the family is like. Find out as much as you can about your client and what they desire so that you could help them and find out how that fits into your curriculum. The fifth one is be aware of your limitations. Don't spread yourself too thin. I'm seeing more and more hybrid systems popping up everywhere, and many martial arts schools are adapting that franchise mentality, especially within their curriculum. For the people that have no curriculum or no idea on what to teach because it hasn't been broken down in the systematic kind of thing, those people, that's okay. You know, those proven franchise mentality systems work. But the boilerplate punch and kick mentality lacks substance. So I personally believe that the martial arts is a life skill, and we need to realize that we teach so much more. And we have to believe that we need to develop our curriculum to support these teachings, the mental, the physical, and the spiritual. And we need to dig deep in to give some substance to our curriculum. There's another popular saying that in the martial arts that a curriculum is personality driven. And my definition of this would be a curriculum that is personality driven is by one specific teacher, that the head or master coach or master instructor is the one that delivers all the messages and teaches the system. So when that person is removed, many of the students quit or get discouraged. For example, if any of you ever want to move into a multiple school scenario, you have to work on your curriculum so that it's not personality driven. But I'm going to also use another buzzword that I kind of coined. But I worked hard on developing a curriculum that's not predicated on who is teaching. Of course, it's nice to be able to have a specific person that has charisma and talent to teach, but you must think about your curriculum and make it stand on its own. I'd rather see a curriculum developed on personality rather than a personality-driven curriculum. For example, when you develop your curriculum, you will do it based on your experiences, your personal experiences, your past experiences, your personality, and so on. When you put it down on paper, normally, just the physical movements are usually transmitted and transferred to the students. So what happens to all those special lessons? You know, if you are the master teacher and then you hire a junior instructor that has super talent, that has been your protege, even though that they have that talent, there's going to be a certain amount of the knowledge that's lost due to the fact that they haven't lived your life. They haven't lived as long as you. They haven't been around as long as you. So the reason why martial arts students stay is for the experience of the master instructor. So what do? I recommend tying in the lessons of the heart and the mind to the curriculum and presenting them in such a way that any instructor can translate the experiences on the training floor as if they were training directly with the headmaster instructor, for example, my teacher from Japan or myself in the dojo. I want my students to learn what I want them to learn. You know, I want them to see and experience things so that when I hear them speak about the art, they're saying things that I believe to be true. I don't want it to be an adaptation of one of my chief instructors only. I want them to still carry through with my lessons. I want you guys as instructors to fine-tune the lessons and teach the people that teach for you how to transmit that information by giving those lessons of spirituality, mental and physical, and bring them into your curriculum and lesson plan so that it can be replicated for each student. Just because you're not there doesn't mean they shouldn't be learning from you. Maybe not directly, you know, hand-to-hand transmission, but they certainly could be learning from you because based on what you say, if it's transferred to the students correctly, they're going to get your lessons. Now, imagine this, going to an Italian restaurant and saying that the food would be good as you say to the customers that it would be better if your mom cooked it because that's where you got the recipe. And it's a shame that it's only going to be fair because she's not here. But you want to be able to replicate that. You want to take that recipe and use it exactly as it was taught to you so that the person who's eating the food experiences what you've experienced. So it's imperative that when bringing your curriculum together that you put a bit of you in it, spiritually, mentally, and physically. A curriculum that is just physical is not going to stand the test of time. Your curriculum has to be able to stand up with the things that are current as well. For example, most martial arts schools are teaching a bit of MMA or Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and I always sell my school in my art of ninjutsu and ninpo and jiu-jitsu as the mixed martial art. It's the original mixed martial art because back in the day of time, we did everything. In fact, I go on as far as saying that, you know, we teach striking, grappling, locks, chokes, defense against weapons, use of weapons, gymnastic rolls, falls, throws, etc. There's not a thing that we don't do. So when someone calls me up and wants MMA mixed martial arts, I tell them that they could come down to us and learn. The selling point of my curriculum is that we teach the spiritual and mental portions of the martial arts as well. So when developing your curriculum, add that into it. And I would go as far as saying teach the stories that you teach to your students to have them available to them on paper or maybe on an audio tape so that they could hear it. Even though that you're not there, you want the students to feel like they're equally as important and informed and they have a bit of you, the master teacher, and they understand who you are, what you look like, what you do, and what your history is so that they can experience that as well. Now, let me, Joanne, take a few seconds because I just did a half an hour straight and I have a ton more stuff to go over, but let me just see if anyone quickly has any questions for me. So if we could open up the lines, if you have any questions so far or comments, please just chime in right now. I'll give it like a minute or two just to go over that. Anybody, speak up when you can.
Ali?
Yes.
Hey, it's Bruce Costa with Tsunami Karate. How are you? I'm wondering how you introduce your senior students into the
I don't know if anyone else is having problems hearing.
Let's everyone hit the star 6 button if we could while Bruce is talking. So, thank you guys. And then we'll open it up after that. So, so Bruce, can you try that again or are you on a cell phone?
No. That wasn't me.
Great.
What I asked was, regarding getting your senior students into teaching positions, what is your protocol for doing that? Do you require it of them as a part of their curriculum? Do you offer them paid positions? Do you just...
We have a bunch of multiple programs that we use to upgrade them So we go, we'll start off our students in a basic program, then we go to Black Belt Club, then we go to Masters Elite, then we have a team leadership character development program, which is on my Next Level site that's working phenomenally for people right now that are using it. And then we have an instructor training program. Our instructor training program doesn't require them to have any rank whatsoever to be in it. And matter of fact, a yellow belt adult or teenager could join our, into our instructor training program and go through a 10-week instructor training course to learn the basic concepts of self-development, self-improvement, and training and teaching. Now, of course, if they're not a black belt, they'll just only be an assistant or a helper on the floor, but they're getting a taste for what we do, and it creates us to have a good bench strength. Also, to answer your question, I don't require any of my students to do teaching. I feel that if they don't want to be there and they haven't shown the desire to do it, then I really don't want them there. And but, you know, I do see the positive traits of getting someone on the floor because they may feel uncomfortable initially, and then once you get them out there, they'll eventually enjoy it and find that they found something that they love. So I don't say that one way is right or one way is wrong. I just don't do it.
So who manages your class schedule, your instructor schedule?
Well, I only have, you see, that's my thing. In all of my schools, I have a set instructor and a set assist instructor, and they teach all the classes. I have a new school that we're working on right now that we're doing a multiple of maybe like four or five different rotating instructors to see how that's going to work without having a set figure on the class. So I don't have really a instructor schedule. I just have individuals that's their primary job.
And so those people who do go through your instructor's training courses, where and when do they teach?
Well, they don't actually teach until we find them a position to teach, a solid position, unless if they're teaching then and they're just helpers.
Mm.
So they become helpers on the floor and they help out the chief instructor of the school.
Okay.
They may fill in on days that people have vacation days or sick days, but I don't give them positions to just come in and teach, although I'm doing a little bit more experimentation with that in this new location where, you know, we're having this totally non-personality driven curriculum, and that it's just individual instructors and they're different every single week and different times and so on. So no one student gets used to a specific phase. They really just fall in love with the curriculum and the school and the lessons.
Mm-hmm. Very, very, very good. I've got a one night a week where I have probably a half a dozen nice, responsible brown belts. I've got 100 students. I teach all the classes myself, and I've got, but one night a week, you know, there was a night a week we didn't have classes Wednesday night, and the seniors approached me. These are all adults who have, you know, positions of responsibility in their lives, physicians, you know, foremen, and so forth, and so every week there's a different instructor teaching on Wednesday night, and everybody knows it, and it's actually a very popular class.
So what, that's interesting. We actually, now that I think about that, we kind of do that in our school, on my headquarters school, and we call it Open Mat on Sunday. And we have 52 different people, well, maybe half that, let's say 30-something people will come in throughout the year and teach one Sunday a year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of almost like what you're doing, but I love that. I think it's a great idea.
Well, I'm in a position that I imagine many of your other listeners are in, and that is that I do it all myself. I so greatly want to refine my curriculum, and I literally don't have the time. And some of my seniors who are closer to me are recognizing that and saying, man, let us take some classes so you can be in the office putting stuff together. You know?
Right. Well, you know what? You need to recognize that before they do. So you need to just start to delegate a little bit more and, you know, actually ask and you shall receive, you know. So go out there and let them take over and start teaching roles and maybe give up a day or two so that you could go home and watch TV and relax or whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure. Hey, let's get one more question, and it'll be a quick one, and then I'll continue on because I do have a lot more to go over. So anybody else real quickly? Okay. All right, Joanne, if we could mute it and we'll get back in. Okay. So stepping right into it, I believe that many times that we do not hold our students accountable for their own progress. In the United States specifically, we are of the mentality that the teacher is responsible for the student's progress and ability. Now, even though this is true to some extent, it's not the student's responsibility to learn and progress. You know, I believe that it is totally on the student. For example, you guys are all martial arts school owners or managers or instructors. If you don't progress in your learning about how to run a business and how to build your curriculum and how to develop personally, I do believe that we will all be extinct very quickly. So it's our responsibility to learn as much as we can and perfect what we do. So why should that be any different for our martial arts or even public students, you know, in public school? So interestingly enough, when I was younger, I remember my mom being upset with the teachers when I didn't do well in school. There's no doubt that there are some teachers that shouldn't be in the profession, and the same goes for martial arts as well. But for those that are doing a good job at transferring information in an interesting yet informative way, they shouldn't be held accountable for the students' shortcomings. I believe that if the curriculum is presented properly and it's engaging enough, it should be the student. And if the student's a younger student, the parents should be responsible to help that student study and learn outside the classroom. If they're unwilling, then it's their fault when they don't pass a test, they don't learn, they don't progress. It's important for us to impart on and to our students and their families that it's their responsibility to do it themselves. We just transmit the lessons. So we transfer the information. That's all basically a teacher could do, is instruct and show based on past experiences. So we need to develop our curriculum to teach these skills. You see, when I talk about curriculum, I just don't mean a kick and a punch and a combination of a, you know, left-right jab or whatever it may be. I mean that we have to include in our curriculum certain things that are expected of our students and teach them why they should act and do a certain thing. So we need to make sure that it becomes a part of our lessons, that our school is, everyone in our school is expected to carry, in my school specifically, everyone is expected to carry a notebook to class. At times we'll do a class where a portion is just taking notes on the names of the techniques or the philosophy and history. I've found that in my training with my teacher that many of the lessons are transferred this way, which they call in Japanese, by the way, bufu, like the wind lessons of speaking, you know. So it's not something that's developed overnight, but once it takes place, it becomes a culture within your school. People, they start to learn at a higher level, and when they're engaged mentally and physically at the same time, they become better students. So people remember better when they're writing things down. So we expect our students to bring notebooks to class each and every day, and we also expect them to understand that this is part of their, they have to practice at home. They have to come to a certain amount of events because that's what's going to make them better students. Now, there's another hot topic that people talk about all the time, and this was one of my emails that I had gotten that's kind of encouraged me to add this into the curriculum, and that's of the revolving curriculum. Now, I can't say whether it's good or not because it has to work specifically for you and your system in school. But I have to be clear that it's not something that I could do in my school entirely the way some people have presented it to me. But I don't have an opinion in either direction whether it's right or wrong, but I do want to point out the way I do things. I believe that the martial arts are based on certain specific lessons, and if I can present those specific lessons a certain way, and make sure that the student absorbs that information, then I've done my job. My curriculum is revolving in nature, but I do it within each student's belt level. So, for example, if they're a white belt, then I would revolve the entire white belt curriculum continually throughout the next month, two, or three, or depending on how long they have to stay in rank. And I'll revolve that entire belt level until they've mastered their techniques, and then they get a stripe on their belt, and then they master the next set, and then they go on to test for the next ranking. So in my school, I have three criteria for promotion and for student rank advancement. The first being a set required amount of classes. So for example, we do our basic program is a three-day-a-week program. So in order to gain your white belt, let's just say from beginner to white belt, because we start off at beginner level in my school with no uniform, and they gain their uniform, and then at the uniform level, they gain their white belt. So let's just say, for example, it's 2 months to get to your white belt, and you have to make 20 classes, 10 classes a month. You also have to know your material. No exceptions. You have to know your material in order to be able to get that. And then there is a specific period of time. For example, you have those superstar athletes that learn so quickly. They still have to be in their belt, as I call it, a maturity time period, where they have to stay in their belt before they're able to get it. So they could be the most talented in the world, and we expect them, and they could, if they put their minds to it, they could probably do it in half the time, But I want them to be able to mature in the belt and sit in that rank for a period of time before they move on. You know, the third most important thing is, of course, that they have to perform all their movements with a proficient ability. And it's required also that they have certain physical movements and exercises in my school. You know, we want our students to be athletes, and we may do hardcore training in class, but we should set out as part of our curriculum at white belt level how many push-ups, sit-ups, jumping jacks, mountain climbers, bends and thrusts they should do. At yellow belt, you know, add on 10 each time. So by the time they get to black belt, they could drop down and do 100 push-ups nonstop. We want them to be physically training their bodies as well, and this also ties into that area where they're starting to lose weight and get in better shape, because we're requiring that they could do 10 push-ups. If we don't require certain things, they're just never going to do them. So those are my three criteria. To truly put it together a curriculum, if you don't have one right now that's set in stone, is not easy. The goal is to look at the levels that you have, whether it be in my school, white, yellow, green, blue, purple, brown, and black belt. And then I want to divide them into categories. So, for example, if it takes only a month to get from beginner to white belt and then 2 months from white to yellow, then I want to maybe divide it down the middle so that in a month's time they get a stripe on their belt and another month that they'll get their next level. So I want to divide it into categories as well as a specific time frame. And then you need to ask yourself, how long should it take to get to a black belt in your school? What is the duration of time that you believe it should take? Now, I'm a creature of this because I used to have a 7-year black belt course. Most people were quitting at purple belt level, which was about the 5 to 5.5 year mark at training. So I was losing them because the duration of time, the time period it took, was just far too long. People lost sight of their goals and their visions. So you need to look at a realistic time frame. You know, some martial arts take 2 years, some martial arts take 3. I could tell you, if you go to Japan and you train in a traditional karate style, you could probably attain your black belt within 2 years, if that. You know, you may get to third or fourth dan within 10 years if you live in Japan. Because people don't, in Japan or some of the Asian cultures, don't really look at the black belt as the most important thing in the world. They think of you as a real martial artist when you're like fourth or third or fourth dan. You also have to ask yourself, what do you believe a black belt to look like, act like, and perform like? So that you could start building your curriculum. Once you have established how long you want it to be and what you want them to look, act, and sound, and smell, and be like, then you start working backwards. That's where you start to say, okay, these are all the things that a black belt should know, and this is what I want them to do. And then I want them to start working backwards, and then I want you guys to start working backwards as you start to develop your curriculum. So it's real, real important for you to have that in the system and have it worked out. And in my school, I have sheets, which we call our Q-level sheets, which tells them the exact level that they are learning, the techniques, what's expected of them, how long, how many exercises, and so on and so forth. And that I share with the students ahead of time so that they know. Even my black belt test is on a sheet. So when my students enter into their 10-week black belt success cycle before they test for their black belt, they have the exact test on paper. So it's almost like, you know, preparing for the test, but knowing it's like an open book test. But I kind of laugh at the mentality and how I was taught. It was almost like a big guessing game. I never knew what was expected of me. So I never knew what to practice, what to do, what to work more on, because I never knew what my teacher wanted. So I just went in blindly. And that's why people fail. They get sick. They don't train. They quit. They lose motivation because we don't give them clear expectations. So these are just some of the things that I've done in order to create a school where I have about 1,150 students and, you know, over 100 black belts training. And I would say over the next 5 years, we should be promoting between 30 to 40 black belts per year. Hopefully, my retention will be as equally as well as it is in the black belt level than it is in the lower level. So then my black belt enrollment will grow to a place where I've never imagined it could ever be. I'd never envisioned having a population of students in the black belt level, a black belt community. You know, just people that are the elite of the elite that have been around for 5 or 6 years that know my philosophy, know my history, know the culture of the school. this to me is one of the most exciting things that you can ever have in a martial arts school. And after all, it's what we all work for. It's just sometimes we self-destruct and we, you know, we put in these little things that will create people to quit and fail. And we don't want to do that. That's why, you know, in early on when I started talking, I said, we really need to look closely at what our goals are. And then we want to look at you know, that goal and be able to transfer that goal to our students. And if we're constantly putting a block in front of them and making it more and more difficult for them to succeed, it's almost like having an employee work for you and then setting them up for failure. So inevitably, you're setting yourself up for failure. So basically, that's the gist of everything that I wanted to talk about today. So I'm going to open up the phone lines for the last maybe 8 or 9 minutes and see if any of you guys have any comments, criticisms, complaints, questions, or whatever. Feel free. So let's open up the lines and also star six your phone if you don't have a question. But let's open it up now for free discussion. So Joanne, if you could do that for me.
Well,
does anyone have any questions?
Yeah. Allie?
Yes, sir.
Hi, this is Chris from San Diego.
Hey, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Very well, can't complain at all.
Awesome. Earlier you mentioned that you thinned your adult curriculum for your for the younger groups.
Right.
What did you mean by thinning the curriculum?
What I did was this. You know, my style, and you teach Kung Fu, right?
Yes.
Okay, so imagine that some of the techniques at the black belt level that you would teach to an adult, you would never teach to a teenager or a child. For example, in our school, we don't want to teach neck breaks, arm breaks, you know, gun techniques, knife slashing, and things like that. So we would thin that out. There's certain topics as well that I don't want a teenager to be, you know, it's not my job to talk about rape and, you know, this kind of stuff and so on, although I may mention an attack, but I don't want to specifically talk about that within a teen class. So I eliminated a lot of the techniques that made teenagers feel uncomfortable. You know, when I look at certain things, it was interesting to see that, you know, I was losing X amount of teenage girls at, let's say, a white belt level. And I realized that it was because I was teaching specific grappling techniques where we know it now as the guard position from Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. So I was taking a boy, a teenage boy, and getting a girl and making a teenage girl put this teenage boy in a guard position, creating huge amounts of uncomfortable feelings. You know, I even did that with adult beginners as well, with women and men. So now I started to segregate those classes and make sure women work with women, and for after a certain ability, you know, and time period that they're there where I know that I could speak to them freely and know that they're comfortable with speaking their mind as well, then I started instituting the techniques and I saw a jump in my enrollment. A funny thing with young teenage girls, too, is they don't really like to do jumping jacks. Yet a lot of martial art classes, and even sometimes I find that I forget and I do jumping jacks. And, you know, they're in this stage where they're growing as, you know, into women and you're not comfortable with certain feelings of their body. So if I force them to do certain things, it may make them feel uncomfortable and they'll quit my school, not even knowing why they don't like my classes anymore. So as weird as that may sound, we as martial artists are not just karate or kung fu guys or whatever, ninjas. You know, we're like psychologists and scientists. Because to have a system that really, really works, we got to find out all the reasons why it doesn't. Of course, we could blast advertisement and get thousands and thousands of people to come, if they come, and grow our school that way. Or we could, and you know, out of the hundreds of thousands of people, find the few that'll last. Or we could fine-tune ourselves to work within the mind and body, you know, of what people think. That makes sense?
Thank you.
So I thinned out the curriculum and I took out the things that were just not specific to that age group.
Okay.
Hey, anybody else?
Lynchy Alley.
Sir, how are you?
It's White Woods and Miley.
Yes, I recognize your voice.
Hi.
How are you?
Okay, let's let that Sensei Woods, Sifu Woods speak and then the next person could go. Go ahead, sir.
Okay, well, you know what my background is, so I just wanted to say that today's call has given me a whole new set of ideas.
Oh, good.
Oh, yeah.
Because I got your email. You were one of the guys who had sent me an email, and you were excited about it. And at the same time, I was kind of, like, apprehensive because, you know, I thought about it more to think, you know, I don't want people to think that maybe I'm trying to teach curriculum because there's boilerplate stuff out there, but there's a certain science to putting a curriculum together.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And you, of all people, you know, come from that mentality of Jeet Kune Do where, you know, everything is open. So to make it almost, to put a curriculum together is almost, I can't even, for lack of better words, is almost going against the tradition of the Jeet Kune Do concepts in a way.
Yeah, it's been tough doing that over the years, but again, information like yours and an outlook like yours is what makes it a lot easier for me.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad I was helped. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Sure thing.
Who was the other gentleman that was going to ask a question?
Hi, Ali.
Yes.
Hi, this is Ken Swan.
Hey, sir. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Very well.
The question I had was, what about students... you know, where you have a group of students that they're just not, you know, sparring or engaging in some type of sparring as part of your curriculum.
Right.
Whether it's for timing or even, you know, getting one person to punch in for another. And students have a difficult issue with that. How would you overcome that in your curriculum, say, whether it's a...
Well, you know what, I know exactly what you're saying because I have that in my school as well. You know, you get those people that they, and I kid around my teenage class, and you could steal this line if you think it's funny, but I say there are a bunch of my students, they basically look like a bowl of Jell-O with skin. You know, they just kind of sit out there and they're just limp, their punches have no energy, they barely could stand up. In fact, some of them fall down on their own without even walking and stand back up on their own again. You know, so it's like one of the, what I've found though is that depending on where they're at, where you expect them to act a certain way, I found that more and more when I explain to people that they have to act a specific way in order for it to be right, they start to learn. Like, for instance, in my school, if you don't ki-eye, there's really not, you know, you have to ki-eye when you're doing a specific movement. So if they don't ki-eye, I have to explain to them that you only did a portion of the movement. It's like doing a horse dance and bending your legs and sitting low, or just opening your legs wide and not sitting at all. One is a horse dance and one is not. So if you could impart on those students that there is a right way and a wrong way, it's almost like writing a letter on the blackboard, and if the letter is not completed, it's not the letter. So this is what I try to say to them, and that this helps them understand that doing it a specific way is the right way to do it. So I put little things within the curriculum, and then I look back and I say, okay, well, maybe for those people, they're just not getting it because we didn't transfer the information properly. And I always try to look back on a better way. I'll give you a perfect example. In my style, we do a lot of ukemi, which are throws and falls, and we, like in Aikido, where we flip through the air and we do this big barrel roll and we hit the ground. And I noticed that my students, a good portion of them, don't fall as well as I would like them to do. And my school is pretty much known for knowing how to fall and flip and so on. And I looked at it going, like, why is this an ongoing issue? And then I realized that when we teach our first roll in the class, you know, when they first begin, we start on the left side. And we roll and we teach them how to roll on their left side. And they continually roll on their left side until they get good at rolling on their left side. But I realized, too, that when we practice a lot of our techniques off of the punch and the throws, we'll do them right-sided, like if we demonstrate it and practice it. And I noticed that the fall comes from the roll. But when we started them at the beginning level, we started them on the left side, and now we're teaching them how to fall, and we're teaching them how to fall on the right side. There's a gap between ability because we should be teaching it all on the right side and then go back and forth and make sure that they could learn it on both left and right. But I wasn't doing that, so there was a gap in people knowing how to fall. So since we've shifted that, everyone is picking up their falls much, much quicker, and they build less bad habits. Unfortunately, you know, a bad habit is easy to develop and hard to break, and a good habit is hard to develop and easy to break. So this is what I look at. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, yes, it does.
Did it answer your question, or did I just ramble?
No. It definitely answered the question. I guess my follow-up to that would be, can you tailor a curriculum to a particular student's needs? I mean, all of our students have different body builds, types, backgrounds. Some,
yes,
you know, potentially come from an abused background.
So yeah.
There's issues of contact or particular grabbing, like you mentioned before.
Yes.
You know, with a teenage girl being on the ground and a guy in a guard position is
right.
A very intimidating position.
You absolutely should be able to tailor your curriculum. I mean, you can't not teach what you do. But there should be certain levels in which you teach. You know, interestingly enough, you know, you could probably take that person who, let's just say, was raped or attacked, and you could probably get them over it, but if you did it in baby steps. Mm-hmm. So you have to look at each individual as an individual. That J. Conrad Levinson seminar today was amazing because he says it's not about traditional marketing where we market to the masses. It's about marketing to the individual because people are tired of being thrown in as a mass marketing kind of thing. I don't think like the masses. So why should everyone else believe? They don't believe they do either. So we have to take each individual and nurture them and cater to them.
Okay.
I'm not saying change your system, but maybe find a special time, a private lesson, or within the classroom, just show them different things. I once had a guy who trained with me, and he had two prosthetic arms. Mm-hmm. And he actually was amazing because he had other arms built where he actually would hold the tomfa, another arm that could hold the bow staff. And when I'd say, okay, we're doing bow staff, he'd run over and plug his arms in. And so it was adaptable to him.
Okay.
But yes, you can, without a doubt. But be careful that you don't sell out just for that individual.
Right, and that's the concern that I have. Is
fine line between, you know, personalized and, you know, being helping, you know, helping one specific person. So be careful, but you could do it easily.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone else? We have one last question. Anybody? Speak up now or forever hold your peace. Okay, everybody, I'm glad to have been on here. I hope that I had given you some information that you may back to what I call the laboratory and enjoy it and practice it. I think that, you know, the curriculum is our baby. It's what we do and who we are. So we have to be very specific on, you know, how we put it together. But at the same time, if I could give you one bit of advice, and as I learn more and more and more, I realize that, you know, it's not about me ever. It's always about the student and the client and the parent. And if they're not happy, you know, we could get certain people to bend to our will or do what we say. But if we're not growing with our students and teaching them and taking them into consideration as the top priority, then we're going to be out of business eventually. So I do believe that, you know, we have to have an open mind and you know, try to find out, look as you would if you were like a researcher and find where you're getting sticking points and problems. So if you want, anyone could email me at renshi.ninja@aol.com. That's renshi.ninja@aol.com. renshi.ninja@aol.com. And I do recommend that you guys email me if you have any questions. And if you're ever interested, take a look at the Taking It to the Next Level site, because we, in the first few months, go pretty heavy into curriculum and watching and looking at statistics and making sure that our curriculum is actually benefiting our school. Sometimes schools are totally set up for failure and they don't even know it. It doesn't matter how much you market, doesn't matter how smart you are at business. If you don't have something that is sellable, people are just not going to buy it. So that's how I'm going to leave off today. I want to thank everybody for listening, and you guys enjoy, and I hope to hear from you on email. Joanne, thanks for being so awesome, and everybody have a great day, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Allie.
Take care.
Bye-bye.